Cars today are built to last, but how they look is up to you, and that's where Maaco comes in. They specialize in cosmetic repairs. Let's say it's affordable paint jobs to fixing those annoying dents and dings. Whatever it is, Maaco has you covered. With more Americans keeping their cars longer, now's the time to protect your investment and keep it looking sharp for years. Get started. Visit your local Maaco today. Get the free estimate and see how easy it is to bring new life to your ride. Uh-oh, better get Maaco.
When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio. When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio.
As 2025 began, the Idaho murders case was entering its final phase before trial. After more than 2 years of investigation, legal battles, and pretrial proceedings, both prosecution and defense teams were making their last preparations for what promised to be one of the most closely watched criminal trials in American history. The case that had begun with four college students' deaths in a small Idaho town was now preparing to unfold in a Boise courtroom where the convergence of cutting-edge forensic science, constitutional law, and the ultimate question of life or death would play out before the nation. Previously on Brian Koberger, how we got here. The September 2024 venue change moved the trial from tiny Lotta County to Ada County in Boise, citing presumed prejudice from extensive media coverage. Judge Stephen Hippler set a firm trial date for August 2025, while the defense developed alternate perpetrator theories, including a two-perpetrator strategy. December 2024, revelations about Koberger's Amazon purchases provided new evidence of premeditation, and victims' families raised over $65,000 to attend the relocated trial. I'm Tony Bruschi, and this is our look back on how we got here in the case against Brian Koberger, and this is Episode 9, Final Preparations. Today we're talking about the final months before trial, as both sides refined their strategies, resolved remaining evidentiary disputes, and prepared for jury selection in one of Idaho's most complex criminal cases. We'll explore the key unresolved issues, the massive logistical preparations, and how a community and nation prepared to witness justice in the digital age. The new year brought a sense of urgency to the case that had been building for over 2 years. With jury selection scheduled to begin on July 30th, 2025, and the trial itself starting August 11th, both legal teams had less than 8 months to finalize their preparations for what Judge Hippler had scheduled as a potentially four-month trial. The timeline was aggressive, but necessary. Death penalty cases can drag on for years in pre-trial proceedings, but Judge Hippler was determined to move forward while maintaining all necessary legal protections for the defendant. The August trial date represented nearly 3 years from the original murders, already longer than many families, and the community had hoped to wait for resolution. The scheduling also had to accommodate the complex logistics of a high-profile death penalty trial. The court needed to coordinate with law enforcement agencies, media organizations, and the numerous expert witnesses who would be traveling from across the country to testify. Summer scheduling would also allow for extended proceedings without conflicts from academic calendars, given that many participants had university connections. For the prosecution team led by Bill Thompson, early 2025 was focused on streamlining their evidence presentation and preparing for the logistical challenges of trying a complex case in a new venue. Thompson, who had been with the case since the beginning, understood that this would likely be the defining case of his prosecutorial career. The prosecution team had expanded to include additional attorneys from the Idaho Attorney General's office, bringing specialized expertise in death penalty litigation and appellate law. This expanded team allowed them to divide responsibilities and ensure that every aspect of their case received expert attention. They had spent months coordinating with Ada County authorities to ensure smooth operations once the trial began. This coordination included everything from evidence storage and presentation technology to witness scheduling and security protocols. Moving a case of this magnitude required essentially recreating their entire operation in a new location. The prosecution's case strategy had crystallized around what they called the convergence theory. The argument that while individual pieces of evidence might be challenged, the combination of DNA, digital, and circumstantial evidence created an overwhelming case for guilt that couldn't be explained by coincidence or error. This strategy was designed to address the reality that modern juries are more sophisticated about forensic evidence than in the past, often having been exposed to crime shows and documentaries that highlight potential problems with forensic science. Rather than relying on any single smoking gun, the prosecution would present multiple independent lines of evidence that all pointed to the same conclusion. Their evidence presentation would begin with the crime scene and autopsy evidence establishing the brutal nature of the murders and the timeline of events. This opening would be designed to help jurors understand the magnitude of the crimes and the suffering of the victims, setting the emotional context for the technical evidence that would follow. The prosecution had worked extensively with victim advocates and the families to determine how much graphic evidence to present. While they needed to convey the severity of the crimes, they also wanted to respect the dignity of the victims and avoid unnecessarily traumatizing the families who would be present in the courtroom. They would then present the DNA evidence linking Koberger to the knife sheath, using expert witnesses to explain not just the statistical certainty of the match, but also the sophisticated laboratory procedures that ensured the reliability of their analysis. They had prepared detailed presentations to help jurors understand the complexity of DNA analysis without overwhelming them with technical details. The cell phone tower data would be presented through a combination of expert testimony and sophisticated visual presentations that would show Koberger's movements over the months leading up to the murders. These presentations would include maps, timelines, and statistical analysis designed to demonstrate the improbability that his presence in the area was coincidental. The surveillance footage capturing his vehicle in the area would be enhanced and presented with expert analysis showing how investigators had identified the specific make and model of car and tracked its movements through multiple camera systems. This evidence would be crucial in establishing Koberger's presence at the scene during the relevant time period. The prosecution had decided to call Koberger's family members as witnesses to testify about the trash collection that had provided the crucial DNA comparison. This decision was strategic but risky, as it would require family members to essentially provide evidence against their own relative in a death penalty case. The decision to call family members as witnesses had been debated extensively within the prosecution team. On one hand, the family members were essential witnesses who could authenticate the trash collection and provide testimony about Koberger's behavior during his visit home. On the other hand, forcing family members to testify against a relative in a capital case raised ethical and practical concerns. The prosecution had worked with victim advocates and legal ethicists to ensure that their approach was appropriate and that the family members understood their rights and options. They had also prepared extensively to make the testimony as non-confrontational as possible while still obtaining the necessary evidence. The family members' testimony would be limited to factual matters about the trash collection and Koberger's presence at the family home. The prosecution would avoid asking them to provide opinions about their relatives' guilt or character, recognizing the impossible position this would place them in. They were also preparing to present evidence of Koberger's internet search history, which they argued showed consciousness of guilt and ongoing interest in the investigation. These searches conducted after the murders included queries about the case, the victims, and topics related to DNA evidence and police procedures. The internet search history evidence had required extensive technical analysis to ensure accuracy and admissibility. Digital forensics experts had verified that the searches originated from devices associated with Koberger and had been conducted during times when he had access to those devices. The prosecution had also worked with behavioral analysts to develop expert testimony about what these searches revealed about Koberger's state of mind and consciousness of guilt. The pattern and timing of the searches would be presented as evidence that he knew he was a suspect and was attempting to monitor the investigation's progress. One of the prosecution's most powerful pieces of evidence was the timeline reconstruction showing Koberger's phone going silent during the exact window when the murders occurred, then reconnecting as he left the area. Digital forensics experts had prepared sophisticated presentations to illustrate this timeline for jurors. The prosecution team had also been working with the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit to develop a profile of the killer that matched Koberger's characteristics. While not admissible as direct evidence, this analysis had helped them understand the psychological aspects of the case and prepare for cross-examination of defense witnesses. In April 2025, Judge Hippler issued crucial rulings on several remaining evidentiary disputes that would shape how the trial would unfold. His decisions on these pre-trial motions represented the final resolution of legal battles that had been fought for months and would determine what evidence jurors would be allowed to consider. The April hearings had been intensive, with both sides presenting extensive legal arguments and expert testimony on the admissibility of various types of evidence. Judge Hippler had taken the unusual step of scheduling multiple days of hearings to ensure that all arguments could be fully presented and considered. The rulings were particularly significant because they would be difficult to challenge on appeal, meaning that the evidence decisions made in April would likely determine the shape of the trial and influence its outcome. Both sides had invested enormous resources in these pre-trial battles, understanding that winning or losing key evidentiary arguments could be more important than the trial itself. On the issue of genetic genealogy evidence, Judge Hippler ruled that the prosecution could present evidence about how investigators had used this technique to identify Koberger as a suspect, but with significant limitations. The defense would be allowed to present expert testimony challenging the reliability and constitutional implications of genetic genealogy. The genetic genealogy ruling was particularly nuanced, reflecting the novel legal issues raised by this emerging technology. Judge Hippler had studied cases from other jurisdictions and consulted with legal experts to develop a framework that balanced the investigative value of the technology with constitutional privacy concerns. The ruling established important precedents about judicial oversight of genetic genealogy and the need for defense challenges to ensure reliability. Legal experts predicted that Judge Hippler's decision would be studied and cited in similar cases across the country. Judge Hippler also ruled on the admissibility of Koberger's Amazon purchase history, determining that evidence of his knife and sheath purchases 8 months before the murders was highly relevant to proving premeditation and planning. This ruling was a significant victory for the prosecution, as it provided clear evidence that the murders weren't spontaneous. The Amazon purchase ruling had required extensive analysis of the timing, nature, and significance of the purchases. The prosecution had presented evidence showing that the items purchased were identical to those found at the crime scene and that the timing suggested long-term planning rather than impulse buying. The defense had argued that the purchases were for legitimate academic or personal purposes and that their connection to the murders was speculative. However, Judge Hippler found that the combination of timing, items purchased, and their connection to the crime scene made the evidence highly probative of premeditation. The court also addressed the defense's alternate perpetrator theories, ruling that they could present some evidence suggesting multiple perpetrators, but that they would need to provide substantial evidence to support specific alternate theories about who else might have committed the murders. One of the most significant rulings involved the defense's request to exclude evidence of Koberger's behavior at Washington State University after the murders. Judge Hippler ruled that evidence of his erratic behavior, inappropriate comments about the case, and ultimate termination from his teaching position would be admissible as evidence of consciousness of guilt. The defense team led by Ann Taylor was facing their own set of challenges as the trial approached. They had assembled a team of experts to challenge every aspect of the prosecution's scientific evidence, but they knew that completely discrediting such strong forensic evidence would be difficult. Taylor had expanded her team to include some of the most respected experts in forensic science, DNA analysis, and digital forensics from across the country. The defense budget for expert witnesses had grown to unprecedented levels for a public defender's office, reflecting the complexity and stakes of the case. The expert team included Dr. Lawrence Kobylinski, a renowned forensic scientist who would challenge the DNA evidence. Dr. Stephen Moore, a digital forensics expert who would question the cell phone tower analysis. And Dr. Park Dietz, a forensic psychiatrist who would provide insights into the psychological aspects of the case. Each expert had been working for months to analyze the prosecution's evidence and develop testimony that could create reasonable doubt. This preparation had included reviewing thousands of pages of laboratory reports, case files, and scientific literature to identify potential weaknesses in the prosecution's case. Their strategy focused on creating reasonable doubt by challenging the reliability of the evidence and presenting alternative explanations for the prosecution's findings. They had hired DNA experts to testify about potential contamination and laboratory error, digital forensic specialists to challenge the cell phone evidence, and criminal profilers to support their alternate perpetrator theories. The DNA challenge would focus on the potential for contamination during collection, storage, or analysis of the knife sheath. Defense experts would testify about the microscopic amounts of DNA involved and the potential for transfer from other sources or laboratory cross-contamination. The digital forensics challenge would question the accuracy and interpretation of cell phone tower data, arguing that factors like weather, network traffic, and equipment malfunctions could affect which towers a phone connects to. They would present alternative explanations for Koberger's phone being in the area that didn't involve criminal activity. The defense team was also preparing to present evidence about Koberger's autism spectrum disorder diagnosis, though they were still refining their approach to this sensitive topic. They needed to educate jurors about autism while avoiding stereotypes that might actually harm their client's case. The autism evidence presented both opportunities and risks for the defense. On one hand, it could help explain some of Koberger's behavior and generate sympathy from jurors. On the other hand, it could reinforce stereotypes about autism and violence that might actually make jurors more likely to convict. Mental health experts retained by the defense had conducted extensive evaluations of Koberger, including neuropsychological testing, clinical interviews, and review of his developmental and educational history. Their findings would be crucial both for challenging the prosecution's case and for potential mitigation evidence if the case reached a penalty phase. So the evaluations had revealed evidence consistent with autism spectrum disorder, including difficulties with social interaction, repetitive behaviors, an intense focus on specific interests. However, the experts would need to explain how these characteristics were relevant to the case without suggesting that autism predisposes someone to violence. The defense was also preparing character witnesses who could testify about Koberger's background, academic achievements, and lack of previous violent behavior. These witnesses would be particularly important if the case proceeded to a penalty phase, where the jury would decide between life imprisonment and death. One of the key unresolved issues heading into trial was the defense's alternate suspect theory, which required them to present evidence by June 18, 2025. According to court deadlines, this evidence would need to meet the high legal standard for suggesting that someone other than Koberger committed the murders. The defense had been investigating several potential alternate theories, but developing sufficient evidence to meet court requirements had proven challenging. They were working with private investigators and forensic experts to analyze every aspect of the case that might support these theories. The most promising of their alternate theories involved the argument that the murders were committed by multiple perpetrators rather than a single individual. This theory was based on their analysis of the crime scene, the timeline of events, and the logistics of attacking multiple victims in different rooms. To support this theory, the defense had hired crime scene reconstruction experts, forensic pathologists, and criminal profilers who would testify about evidence suggesting multiple attackers. They argued that the coordination and timing required to kill four people in different locations suggested more than one perpetrator. The prosecution had anticipated these alternate theories and was prepared with rebuttal evidence. They had conducted their own crime scene analysis and consulted with experts who would testify that all evidence was consistent with a single perpetrator acting alone. As the trial date approached, both sides were also preparing for the massive logistical challenges of trying a death penalty case in the media age. The trial was expected to attract hundreds of journalists, legal observers, and members of the public, requiring extensive security and crowd control measures. The logistics of managing such a high-profile trial were unprecedented for Ada County. Court administrators had spent months planning for the influx of media, the security requirements, and the extended duration of the proceedings. They had studied how other jurisdictions had handled similar cases and implemented best practices for crowd control and security. Judge Hippler had implemented comprehensive media protocols designed to balance public interest with the need for a fair trial. These protocols included limitations on cameras in the courtroom, designated areas for media representatives, and strict guidelines for reporting on evidence and testimony. The media protocols had been developed in consultation with First Amendment lawyers, media organizations, and court security experts. The goal was to ensure transparency while preventing the trial from becoming a circus that could interfere with the administration of justice. The courtroom itself had been modified to accommodate the large number of participants and observers. Additional seating had been installed for media representatives, the victims' families, and members of the public, who would be selected through a lottery system for the limited available seats. The Ada County Sheriff's Office was coordinating security for the trial, working with federal agencies to ensure the safety of all participants. The courthouse would be operating under heightened security measures throughout the trial with additional screening procedures and expanded law enforcement presence. Security planning had included threat assessments, coordination with federal agencies, and development of emergency protocols for various scenarios. The sheriff's office had also worked with media organizations to establish guidelines for equipment and personnel that would be allowed in and around the courthouse. The prosecution was preparing 3D models of the crime scene that would allow jurors to virtually walk through the house at 1122 King Road and understand the layout and sequence of events. These models, created using advanced forensic technology, would provide a more immersive experience than traditional photographs or diagrams. The 3D models had been created using laser scanning technology and photogrammetry to capture every detail of the crime scene with millimeter accuracy. Jurors would be able to view the models from any angle and understand the spatial relationships between different rooms and areas of the house. The technology also allowed prosecutors to overlay evidence locations, blood spatter patterns, and other forensic findings onto the 3D model, creating a comprehensive visualization of the crime scene that would be far more effective than traditional evidence presentation methods. They were also preparing enhanced versions of surveillance footage that would clearly show Koberger's vehicle in the area around the time of the murders. Digital enhancement techniques had improved the quality of these images significantly since the original investigation, making details visible that weren't apparent in the original footage. The defense was preparing their own demonstrative aids to illustrate their alternate theories and challenge the prosecution's timeline. They had created presentations showing how multiple perpetrators might have moved through the house and attacked the victim simultaneously. Both sides were also preparing for the penalty phase of the trial that would occur if Koberger was convicted. The prosecution was compiling aggravating evidence about the heinous nature of the crimes, the impact on the victims' families, and the threat that Koberger posed to society. The defense was preparing extensive mitigation evidence about Koberger's background, mental health, and potential for rehabilitation. This evidence would include testimony from family members, mental health experts, and character witnesses who could speak to factors that might warrant a life sentence rather than execution. The victims' families were making their own preparations for what they knew would be an emotionally devastating trial. They had been working with victim advocates to understand the trial process, prepare for the difficult testimony they would hear and manage their expectations about the proceedings. Each family had made different decisions about how much of the trial they wanted to attend. Some family members planned to be present for every day of proceedings, while others chose to attend only for opening statements, closing arguments, and the verdict. The victim advocates had helped them understand that there was no right or wrong choice, and that they should prioritize their own emotional well-being. Some family members were planning to provide victim impact testimony during the penalty phase if Koberger was convicted. This testimony would allow them to speak directly to the jury about the impact of their losses and what justice meant to them. Preparing for this testimony required working with prosecutors and victim advocates to craft statements that would be both powerful and legally appropriate. The families had also been coordinating their media strategy, working with victim advocates and legal advisors to determine how much they wanted to engage with the extensive media coverage expected during the trial. Some families chose to designate specific members to speak with media, while others decided to avoid interviews entirely during the trial period. The University of Idaho community was also preparing for the renewed attention that the trial would bring. The university had implemented support services for students, faculty, and staff who might be affected by the trial coverage and testimony. These services included counseling support, academic accommodations for those directly affected, and resources for managing the emotional impact of reliving the tragedy. The university was also coordinating with law enforcement to ensure campus security during the trial, recognizing that the renewed focus on the case might create additional safety concerns or unwanted attention on campus. Security measures included increased patrols, enhanced monitoring of social media for threats, and coordination with federal agencies about potential security risks. In Moscow, the community that had been most directly affected by the murders was preparing for the strange experience of watching their tragedy play out in a distant courtroom. Local officials were coordinating with media outlets to manage the expected influx of reporters and maintaining support services for residents who might be re-traumatized by the trial coverage. The city had established a media center away from residential areas to accommodate the journalists who would be covering the trial from Moscow's perspective. This helped protect residents' privacy while still allowing media access to the community most affected by the crimes. Both sides were preparing extensive questionnaires that would help them evaluate potential jurors' backgrounds, attitudes, and potential biases. These questionnaires would cover everything from media consumption habits to personal experiences with violence and attitudes toward mental health issues. The prosecution's questionnaire focused on identifying jurors who could fairly evaluate complex scientific evidence and, if convinced of guilt, impose the death penalty for multiple murders. Questions addressed attitudes toward law enforcement, experience with DNA evidence, and willingness to consider capital punishment. The defense questionnaire emphasized identifying jurors who might be skeptical of forensic evidence, sympathetic to mental health issues, or opposed to the death penalty. Questions explored attitudes toward autism spectrum disorders, experiences with false convictions, and personal beliefs about redemption and rehabilitation. Both sides understood that jury selection could determine the trial's outcome. Death penalty cases require death-qualified jurors, people willing to consider both life imprisonment and execution. This requirement often excludes potential jurors who might be most sympathetic to defendants, creating a jury pool that tends to be more prosecution-friendly. Brian Koberger himself was spending these final months in solitary confinement at the Ada County Jail, where he had been transferred from Idaho's maximum security prison system. According to court filings, he was being held in protective custody due to the high-profile nature of his case and potential security threats. His daily routine consisted of 23 hours in his cell, with 1 hour for exercise and showers. He was allowed limited phone calls to his attorneys and family members, but all communications except attorney-client conversations were monitored and recorded. He had access to legal materials and was spending much of his time reviewing case documents and consulting with his defense team. Jail officials reported that Koberger's behavior had been generally compliant, though he remained largely isolated from other inmates. His mental health was being monitored by medical staff, particularly given his autism spectrum disorder diagnosis and the stress of facing potential execution. The prosecution team had completed their evidence processing, claiming 95% completion of all forensic analysis. This included final DNA testing, digital forensics analysis, and preparation of all physical evidence for trial presentation. They had also completed interviews with all potential witnesses and finalized their witness list. The final witness list included over 100 potential witnesses, ranging from first responders and crime scene investigators to DNA experts and behavioral analysts. The prosecution had worked to streamline this list to avoid overwhelming the jury while ensuring they could prove every element of their case. Evidence storage and presentation had required extensive coordination between Idaho and Ada County systems. Hundreds of pieces of physical evidence needed to be transferred, cataloged, and prepared for courtroom presentation. This included the knife sheath, blood evidence, surveillance equipment, and digital devices seized during the investigation. Next time on Brian Koberger, how we got here. The final episode of our series takes us to the courthouse steps as jury selection begins. The opening statements that will frame the battle between prosecution and defense in our analysis of what this case means for the future of criminal justice in America.
When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio. When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio. Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it. Your neighbors know it. Heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio. When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio. Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it. Your neighbors know it. Heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio. Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it. Your neighbors know it. Heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio. When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio.
Chances are you've been to the doctor recently, and you probably handed over your insurance, your ID, and even your Social Security number. Your doctor is just one of many places that has your personal info. And if any of them accidentally expose your details, you could be at risk for identity theft. LifeLock monitors millions of data points a second. If you become a victim, they'll fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.